we're building up a list of topics we could just go back and look at too at some point.
No, I want to do this one. I already hit record, Rob.
You did?
I did. I'm recording now. So, I mean, I can always stop if you're really uncomfortable about it.
That's fine. Let's go.
But I know what kind of man you are. You are a man like me who embraces the unexpected and enjoys a challenge. Is it difficult? Is it probably not a good idea? Let's do it. The Stenzinger coat of arms and so on. Hey, Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com.
Hey, Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com. We kind of have a little bit of a Cato, Inspector Clouseau relationship sometimes, huh?
What makes it? Oh, God, I'm sorry.
Because, you know, I just went into the icebox to grab a refreshing beverage and you jumped out with the cleaver, you know?
Oh, is it bad mojo to podcast while you're sick? I don't know. I mean, I know it's considered bad form to eat while you podcast, but you know, should I wait until I'm not slightly congested? Picked up con crud at the American Library Association conference, everybody.
Man, it sounds like you earned it though. It sounds like it was quite a marathon of great daytime work and good connection with other artists.
It was fun. It was fun, and I mean, I'll link to Derek Kirk Kim's video that he put together highlighting a bunch of artists' reactions to the show. I might do some kind of like post of some sort to summarize my feelings about what I learned from doing the show. But I don't want to, you know, eat up any time on that on this one. But yes, it was fun. I sold better than I've done at most other Comic-Cons, certainly better than at traditional Comic-Cons. And I had a lot of fun hanging out with the cartoonists there. So, the end. ALA. Oh, and I got sick. So what have you been up to?
So it sounds like you had a good summer. You had a good summer, but you broke your arm. But now it's good and you're back. And yeah. you have new clothes and books and stuff to start the year. Right.
And eventually Winnie and I are going to straighten things out. And after when the new school year begins, we'll start afresh. And I'll get my learner's permit. And Dad will let me try out driving the car.
Get by with a little help, huh? So... Let's see. It does sound like a pretty cool show. And not to delve into this, but I oftentimes come back from events with, let's see. I think a lot of events can have this effect. Comic conventions, you know, aren't exempt to this, but maybe it's like where you have this high, right? You go there and you connect and you immerse yourself so deep beyond your normal day-to-day immersion in some thing.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a band or a topic you want to study more, or, you know, you do a huge combination of things at a comic show. I mean, do you come back with that kind of,
what,
I don't know.
Like a glow?
Like a glow, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, of course I do. Especially when I have a really good time. I mean, like when I did some other shows that I did audio reporting from where I had less of a good time. No, I didn't come home with that glow. I came home with a sense of like, oh, thank God it's over. I mean, it's like, you know, this visual art biz is often a very solitary affair. And when you get to go and spend time around your people, you know, your tribe or whatever you want to call them, and then get to do stuff with them in a social capacity afterwards where maybe you're not talking about comics anymore. Maybe you're just talking about just other things that you care about, like things that inform why you love comics or whatever your, you know, chosen art field is. Of course you're going to feel great. I mean, to use the analogy you used, it's like summer camp, right? You have all these magical interactions and experiences and, you know, you're not going to see these people again on a regular basis. So you do a lot of high fives and handshaking at the end and see you on Twitter and, you know, see you at the next show. Everybody was asking, you going to be at San Diego Comic-Con? You going to be at San Diego? No, I'm not going to be at San Diego. I have to wait till next year, next summer camp. But, but yeah, of course you do. If you want to go down this road, one of the bigger takeaways was, feeling a connection to something. And not a connection like, oh, we're buds, we're bros, you know, it's me and my posse and we're all going to, you know, Olive Garden and we're going to whoop it up. It's more like feeling like you're part of a shared mission of some sort. You know, I was on some panels there. I was in Dave Roman's Comics Quickfire event I posted some pictures on Google Plus about this, which again I can link to in the show notes. But it was like a game show. It's like a game show with drawing where two librarian team captains were chosen to select from four cartoonists who got to be on what team. I was picked last, which I tried to make a joke out of. You know, it's like, oh, just like junior high all over again. And people were like feeling bad for me. Like, oh, I'm like, no, I don't feel bad. I was trying to make fun of the situation.
We're not jocks enough to appreciate that. We're sad too now.
I know. Actually, that's probably what it was. See, it was the wrong place, the wrong time for me to make that joke. But and so then when we were different teams, the audience would provide a title for a story, and then we would have to improvise. Each cartoonist and team captain would have to improvise one panel of the story and switch off to the next panel. And each audience or each team member was given 1 minute, 60 seconds to draw each panel. So first one's up, team A goes up, and it's you know, the Pumpkin's Last Stand. And so the first guy draws like a pumpkin and a pumpkin patch and a scarecrow. Okay, minutes up. Now, second panelist, you got to, you know, build the conflict. What's the conflict going to be, guys? 60 seconds. Panel three, they introduce a twist to the story. And the audience members get to just throw in some random thing that has to be introduced into the story. They introduce it, and another team member goes back to do panel four to complete the story. And then at the end, both stories are evaluated by the crowd with applause to see who goes to the final round. Where it's epic draw, where you have to combine 10 awesome things into one great big giant drawing. So it's just a big fun game. It's a big spectacle for everybody to get involved in and for the audience members to participate in a low risk fashion. But you're up there with people that you don't know. You know, I was up there with Jen Wang, who did the book Coco Be Good. I'm familiar with the work, never met the woman in my life. Jacob Chabot, who he's doing the Voltron comics right now. Awesome, awesome artist. Never met the guy before in my life. And afterwards, after doing this fun game, you're all in it together. You're all in it to just like, let's put on an awesome show for these people. Let's put on an awesome comics competition where we're going to pretend to be like competing with one another. Like, you're going down, Chabot. Oh, yeah, in your dreams, Drozd, you know, that kind of thing.
Sounds awesome.
So, yeah, it was fun. But, I mean, the thing that really struck me is that getting involved in this kind of stuff gives you a sense of connectedness to an overall mission, right?
Yeah.
Non-competitive. I don't want to sound like some kind of touchy-feely camp counselor who's like, we're all winners. But the coming out on top and the being a show-off, that really wasn't the point of it. That was fun. It was fun to do all that kind of like posturing and joking around and stuff. But what really felt good about it was just feeling like, hey, we're all in this thing together. And in some kind of small way, I'm connected to something that is making more people excited about comics. So that's the glow that I get, is it a sense of connectedness, even if it's not friendship per se, right? It's like, it's not that desperate kind of like, oh, hopefully I'll make a friend here. It's more like, wow, I did a cool thing with a bunch of nice people. We all shook hands afterwards and I get to go home.
Ah, cool. I think so. If you really characterized, let's say there's two kinds of glows you could get. Well, there's more, obviously. There's, sure, you know, as many glows as there are colors in the rainbow, right?
Oh, but, wow. We are all winners.
Yeah, exactly. I have a trophy. Do you have a trophy? We all have a trophy. So it's the, There's another kind of glow that has a distinctive difference to it than what you describe. What you describe sounds like it's very purposeful, related to your mission, and it's ongoing, and it has sort of a sustainable perspective to it versus something else that maybe it was more about being immersed in a bigger picture, but then coming off with ideas that don't really connect to your day-to-day as much, right?
Yeah.
So something where... if it was all about, I don't know, it's like selling the, well, I think about professional conventions as where, you know, going for a work event or whatever, where getting immersed in like the next thing in your industry. Like I remember ages ago going to events like for Microsoft things, right? And that's all tied into the life cycle of a company who's selling something or whatever that it didn't really... Some of it could be exciting and sustainable, like new, like back when Internet Explorer 3 was new and there was a lot of advances in HTML or whatever. It's like, yeah, some of that carried on to other browsers and whatnot. But some things were just very, you know, Microsoft product focused and whatever. Maybe it affects your life later, maybe it doesn't. But it's just not as...
But that relationship is very defined, right?
Yeah.
We are the makers of things. You are the consumers of things. You are our customers, and we want you to be really happy. But that is where that clear definition puts like a boundary around how that relationship works, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you feel connected to Microsoft's mission, right? You know what I mean?
Sure. But the crowd, you do share some common interests. It's not as probably as well knit as a comic industry event like what you described, especially something with the feel of, you know, ALA.
Yeah.
But you have a mission where you want to build stuff. Like you want to get paid to build cool stuff. And you're finding potentially some of the coolest new raw materials to be building things with. So
that's true. I mean, like if you go to a developers conference, I'm sure there's some kind of camaraderie that comes out of all being developers together in the room when the guy walks on the stage and says, this is the exciting thing that we're going to introduce this year that you guys are all going to have to work hard to catch up on.
Yeah. Right? Or, I guess years ago I went to the game developer conference, 2004. And yeah, anyway, that had kind of a mix. It was both a bit like the comic event you described, and also a mix with just people on a mission to support independent game development, or getting their creative discipline represented more in games, like, you know, doing more cool things with sound or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
yeah,
I don't know, interesting stuff. And so maybe there's different kinds of glows as far as Leos, things that are more like what you. Interests that you have that are long-term and then other things that are just kind of,
All I'm describing is what I was
exciting fun.
I was just describing things that are important to me when I go to an event, right? Yeah. Like I'm a guy who goes to Transformers conventions every once in a while, and I'm not there to necessarily make friends. I'm there to, you know, meet some people who are involved in the shows and toys that I love so much. I thinking about it, I don't often come home with that sense of connectedness to anything. It feels more like the glow comes from, I got to say the thing I always wanted to say to that guy who did a character that I really liked, you know. But I don't feel like when I'm waiting in line, I'm not talking with all my other fellow Transformers fans, you know, like there's no shared event kind of thing, right?
Except, yeah, your mission for you isn't like you all are trying to create a bigger fandom for everyone in the world.
Right.
You're there to celebrate your own fandom.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
But jumping back to the other feeling, and I will actually steer back toward our main topic.
Okay,
which
thank
I've
you.
Been dodging. let's see. You reminded me the way you described that as far as really feeling the bigger sense of community and mission. Related to comics, I went to the first Webcomics Weekend.
Oh yeah,
A few years back. Gosh, when was that? 2009.
2009, I think.
I think
it was.
February. Yeah.
I'll and look it up while you talk.
And it was the first comic related convention I ever went to. Period. You know, that was it. I didn't table. It's a very small group of people that were tabling. But I did get to witness and, talk to people who were tabling and see this huge crowd that were there to support this, what seemed like such an indie garage movement, right? It felt like a movement. I could say that, where before I went, I didn't know what to expect, right? I mean, definitely I didn't expect to feel like I'd been part of some big community. That seemed like it was just scratching the surface of how large that community was, and the love they had for the supporting those artists who were embarking on that quest to find their audience and share their voice and do it via comics that are self-published. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I was blown away by that.
I remember you talking about that before. It looks like it was 2010 is when it started. At least that's as far back as the archives go on the Webcomics Weekend website.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 2009 because I went to Baltimore Comic Con. My first tabling was October.
You are right.
2009? Yeah.
Yeah, New England Webcomics Weekend 2 was November 6th through 7th, 2010. So you are right, as Speak and Spell says.
You are correct. Yeah, anyway, that's a good feeling. I know what isn't a good feeling.
Okay, let's talk about what's not a good feeling. We're going to have some therapy today. We're going to talk you off the ledge, Rob.
I know what isn't a good feeling is facing the dark side of creativity and knowing, especially knowing better and then not choosing to do better.
Yeah.
And then having this feedback loop. So for me, I've had this quirk of the last couple of months. Actually since February, I think I broke silence a little bit with the Polytechnic cast in the meantime, but not much. I mean, I've been building, an archive of things I haven't been sharing, which is this old habit that like I haven't had in ages and ages. I don't know.
Did you like dragons when you were a kid? Like in Dungeons and Dragons, were dragons your favorite monsters?
Dragons likely were my favorite monsters. I also liked mind flayers.
I don't know what those are.
Mind flayers, they look like if Cthulhu were in a Def Leppard video, that's what they look like.
Oh, I'm looking those up for the show notes. Mind flayers. No, but yeah, dragons are the things that hoard things, right? I mean, that doesn't take a large leap of imagination to make that connection. Guys who just sit on a big pile of stuff that they can't use.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's exactly. I mean, dragons are hoarders and defenders of the norm where they get to, yeah.
But, okay, so you got this big pile, you got this big backlog of stuff that you're not sharing.
Yes.
And
but we've been doing the Lean Into Art cast in the meantime and whatnot.
I know. I mean, like what makes it easier for you to do this than to share the Technicast?
I tell you what, because we, part of it is I've been realizing because of my, I don't know, a lot of things. Somebody like my work situation changed and it's been changed for a lot of, there's a lot of good in its change, right? Because I feel like I'm working out a lot when it comes to my creative process, and where when I was independent for the last 6 years, I had every aspect of my business to be concerned about, right? That would divide up my time and my focus. Now I'm in a machine that's actually running well, and my opinions are my own, whatever, right? So they're not my employers, and I have an employer. It makes me itchy to say I have an employer, but I actually like my employer.
Well, then that's not a big deal.
Yeah, but it just still feels weird because I've been independent for a decent chunk of time.
Yeah.
And let's see. So I've been face to face with my needs to, that I, how my creative process in cranking out valid work products for user experience and recommending site strategy things and whatnot. So from information architecture deliverables to whatever. Because I'm on a bunch of projects all at once and I just basically wade into it, and I've practiced enough where I'm able to kick butt and go home and I get all my work done and I don't have to focus on all this other marketing or whatever. I just come in and out of these dynamically formed teams.
Yeah,
that there's so many cool people to work with. And we jam out good things and we take on our different roles. And I don't have to think too far into everyone else's role and whatnot and manage in the way that I needed to when I was fully independent for at least the service I'm offering, right?
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so I'm really feeling pretty good about, I'm cranking out a lot. It's a mixed bag as far as, you know, well, guess what? It's all under NDA, right?
Yeah.
Always a mixed bag. And so actually I've never really been able to celebrate NDA, even though I've perpetuated that a little bit back in my early company days. But yeah. Anyway, so I'm faced with this and I'm feeling pretty darn good and effective. But one thing that I realized from that is my first drafts suck. Not completely invalid, but they're often, like along the lines of doing a comic, they are a rough expression early on of what the final result needs to be,
mm-hmm.
where they have enough validity to keep continuing. But like, it's rare if I can really, I don't think I ever nail it the first time, right? With any of these thing. So like, and I'm experiencing that so much every day, where I love and embrace iteration even more than ever, but doing a podcast solo, the only way for me to iterate really is to record it again. Whereas when we're conversing, it morphs and it lives between us, right? And we converse and we both create this thing. Mm-hmm. I get to reflect and iterate while we're talking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the big difference. So the Polytechnicast has stagnated, whereas this podcast continues. And I feel like we've been doing good things.
I'm dwelling on this. Because I was prepared to hear like, oh, well, when we do it together, I'm not as culpable because it's two men in the boat making the thing, right? And so if it's bad, then I can always point at the other guy.
I'm not into that crap. I will embrace I will take accountability as quickly and early as I can, because I think that's a baloney part of conversation.
Do you think that part of it has to do with like the energy of creating something with somebody makes the act itself a little bit more entertaining than creating on your own? Because you get surprised, right? It's like you get surprised when you're working with somebody else, even when it's on a static project like a comic, you get surprised when they do something that you wouldn't do, and you have to go, whoa, do I agree with this? Or is this making me think in new ways about it? Or do I outright reject this? Do I say, no, you did it wrong, right?
You're practically narrating my thoughts in my head right now. So, yes, that does happen. Yes. I get to, it's a wonderful aspect of podcasting together and collaboratively, right? One way to look at it, I guess my motivation isn't to dodge accountability. Right. I enjoy the benefits of us working together on this, and it's a shared product. I enjoy that a lot.
Yeah.
And take advantage of it and embrace it. But not to, you know, shirk away from trying to make it good or be like, well, we failed. Thankfully, I didn't do it alone, you know?
At least I took him down with me.
Exactly.
But it does get me thinking about how also there's a sense of even when you're, whether you're collaborating on something like we're doing now or whether it's a book or whatever, there's a sense of feedback that's happening mm-hmm. in the creative process. When you're working your day job, there's a yeah. sense of feedback.
Holy crap, there is. Yeah.
Yeah. You're getting
floating some, in it.
You're getting a reaction to what you're doing, good or bad, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
When I was, you know, when I do my thumbnails of my comics, which, you know, sometimes thumbnails are done like months before I finally get the time to sit down, pen to paper, I show them to friends because I need that response. I need somebody to say something about it, good or bad. I need to know if it's going anywhere or if I'm just in some kind of nutty tunnel. And it's tough when you're doing, like, it's like, let's talk about Thunder Punch Daily for a second, which I haven't updated in since February. And I want to, it really comes down to a time thing, a time and energy thing, I should say. You know, I don't get a ton of response to anything that I do on there. I get a few people who said, like, one very nice gentleman said some kind words on Twitter about how he was blazing through the archives and it was keeping him company at the art desk. And he was thanking me for that. I was like, well, that's very nice to hear. You know, Tony Cliff said some nice words about Thunder Punch Daily on the Comics Are Great show. But I don't get a whole lot. I never got like a whole lot of like instant reactions to anything that I said. Probably because I'm a non-confrontational type of guy and I don't say anything that makes a whole lot of people angry. But that also makes it kind of harder when you're sitting there alone behind the mic, right? Is that, and I'm hoping that this can be an illustration for anybody from any creative field, is that this sense of screaming into the void makes it really hard to push the publish button, right?
Yeah, that is a huge part of it. I do get feedback from time to time on the Polytechnicast, but at the same time, yeah, a lot of it is screaming into the void. And ironically, so I recently listened to the both the second and third episodes of the Kids Comics Revolution podcast, an excellent show put on by Jersey Drozd and Dave Roman, that you had a guest. Was it Kazu Kibuishi?
Kazu Kibuishi.
And he mentioned the idea of the quiet many versus the loud few.
Yeah.
Very interesting, because chances are if you're creating things that are speaking to an audience that has some commonality with yourself and your perspective, that do you go around commenting on every single thing you like?
Precisely, right? Like if somebody like this probably happens to you, like you go to like a clothing department store and then like you buy a pair of slacks and like, oh, who helped you today? And you're like, that guy, you know, you never even remember their name, you know, even if they did like really awesome helping service and whatever. It's like, I'm always like, it was a guy with glasses. He was over there. I don't remember his name. And I think the joke I made on the show was like, is like some stand-up comedian once said, like, when you see the car that says the how's my driving dial 1-800 blah, blah, blah. Nobody ever calls to say, oh, that guy did an amazing job taking a right turn. You know, we don't do that.
It's funny. I mean, yeah, how you measure stuff and whatnot. I mean, I know you notice this all the time when you're thinking like systemically about when you're making a system or you're coming up with an approach for doing what you want to do with your comic or your business, and how you measure stuff and how you observe what you measure and all that. It can really affect what you do. You know, like you could get distracted by waiting for a reaction sometimes, if you get caught up in that, or distracted by, I don't know, noise. Sometimes reactions and feedback are noise. And that's hard. Like, so if you have this inconsistent pattern of noise and silence and sometimes good feedback and whatever, and maybe a little bit of, so I'm describing my situation now with this extra tension of, I don't know, a shift in lifestyle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I had a certain lifestyle and approach for my day to day for like 6 years, and then now that changed. It changed, you know. So yeah, that's a bit of a shakeup. Maybe that's part of it. I go into this, I actually, in one of the two that I may just blast out, right, and share as soon as we hang up on this podcast, one of them is I ask myself, why am I doing this?
Yep.
And so I actually recount the experience of listening to the Art and Story Supreme service. And okay. I characterize the benefit I received from listening to each of your podcasts, Jersey and Mark Rudolph's and Kevin Cross's.
Talking about the microcasts that we were doing.
It was a transformative experience for me.
Was it?
Yeah. Cause it addressed it. So it's this weird combination of so when you learn something, you may be getting into territory that you're not totally familiar with, but chances are if you're making progress through it, you're familiar enough with it to know if you're progressing, right?
Okay.
So like you each had different perspectives, have different perspectives on that. Well, what is that art cast for, and what are your things that you're taking on, and how do you look at them and whatnot?
Yeah.
And I identified with each one of you in different ways. Yeah. And
so you were our target audience. Too bad there's only one of you. No, there were lots of people who were listening to that, actually.
Yeah, and that was cool, too. That, speaking as far as feeling like a great sense of belonging, that was a great community to be a part of. Very interesting that, you know, hearing those different perspectives and then realizing that part of what you guys were demonstrating, what you were modeling, so you were saying, you know, you're like three male models. And I was like, I want to look like that.
Maybe Mark and Kevin. I was probably, you know, more of the copywriter in that situation. You don't want to see me in those underwear.
Nope. You're up, all of you on the catwalk.
Oh, God.
No. It's, all right, whatever. I'm not,
I know you're, yes.
I'm playing. But you were modeling and demonstrating, like, hey, here is a way to be an intentional creator. That's my paraphrase. I love that thinking of it as being intentional. And how, if you are you intentional in the beginning of the process, at the end of the process, in the middle, all through? How does that work? And then sharing it and, you know, making it you're owning your knowledge more when you can express it like that. So anyway, I'm like, okay, boom, I'm starting a Polytechnicast. And that's because I wanted to experience those benefits as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember reporting very early on with the Art and Story Show that one of the benefits I started receiving out of trying to constantly be coming up with new topics week to week was it forced me to be a lot more mindful about what I was doing each week, right? And look for what are the observable moments? What are the moments that are worth looking at and reporting on? Which made me more intentional on everything that I did at the desk. Well, that's a very nice thing to hear. I'm glad that you know, something that I did made somebody happy. But but what you're talking about is what most people. What I didn't mean to make it sound negative.
No, thanks, kid.
No, I don't know how to respond to that. But you know, you're talking about how most people get inspired to do anything. They see somebody doing something that makes them have a reaction, and they say, "I want to do that for other people too."
Totally.
And I want to reap the benefits that they're reaping because they're doing this thing. That's why I got into comics. Is I had an emotional, visceral reaction to something that made me say, "I want to do that for other people." Right.
Yep.
Still working on that part, but anyway, but this idea of like getting hung up and not letting yourself release it, it reminds me of a lot of different things. And you know, I'm guessing as I throw these different pieces on the table, we're going to find out it's probably a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But, mm-hmm. you know, I gotta throw this at you as this point blank, Rob. Do you think that maybe part of this has something to do with not wanting a checkered past? Meaning... Mm-hmm. Not wanting your legacy or your history. You don't want anything in your search, in a search index, to show you in a poor light. Even if the latest thing you did is totally awesome, even if you like through iterating and through doing lots and lots of things, you get pretty good at it. Like even where you know you're really good at it, that kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. But there's this one 4 years ago where you just sounded, you said something stupid, you said something that was ill-informed or ignorant, and you did a really poor job of representing your point, and somebody's going to hear that. Is that part of what stops you, or is that not even in your mind? Or did I just put a poisonous thought in your mind?
Actually, I want to end the show.
Show over. Knock the mic down.
I am fully poisoned now, and I have to stop talking. That's definitely part of it. I would say I'm curious what the shopping list is now, because now so far, yes to one, but let's see how many poisons I got. But let's see, thinking about what I make and then being worried that I'm creating, I have creations that aren't the best that I can do, right? And then collecting those. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of it. And I, you know, it totally relates to that whole first draft problem, because almost every time, almost every time when I record a solo podcast, I think I could have said that better. I could have said that in less time.
You probably could.
And almost always I can and do, because I often will just delete that version and then record it again. But then guess what? Now that I have that one done, I could have said it better. And I could have said it in a little less time.
Does it really get better?
No. I mean, there's diminishing returns at a certain point. And then you lose an essence.
Yeah.
Like over noodling on something.
Yeah. I mean, like whenever I've done, like after a fifth take of anything, it starts to snuff the life out of it. You know, it just becomes me reciting words. And
yeah. I don't care anymore. It's like now that thing, I had a spark, I had a fire in my belly to say these words. Yeah. And poof, you know, there's not even a smoldering set of embers there.
And not to qualify a statement, but I mean, I do know that I'm coming from a very specific standpoint of a guy who actually enjoys improvisation. I didn't always. I learned to really love figuring things out on the fly and stop distancing myself enough from it. So where if I really suck, I don't dwell on it too much. Not too much. I do dwell on it though.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to back up a second, because something about this whole idea of having like a history that is free of blemishes, something I've become increasingly annoyed with, and this is where I'm possibly going to get a little angry. And I may have talked about this before, but there's this idea that marketing pushes on us, and I think for corporations this makes sense, but I think for people this is absolute poison. Is we have to be consistent. We have to be absolutely cohesive, consistent, whole human beings, and we have to present ourselves in a narrative that does not contradict itself. And to which I say, that's great, but now you're not a human. Because humans act different ways in different contexts. Humans act different ways depending on their mood, depending on whether they're hungry, depending on whether they didn't get enough sleep. We're human beings, and we get to be inconsistent. And to demand for us to be, like, this is like what the kid who wants the very first page of their graphic novel to look exactly like the last page of their graphic novel, to which I say, that's not going to happen. If that happens, you are stagnant. You are a ghost. You are not a living creature. So suck it up and learn to deal with the fact that your early work is going to suck. If you can't, then you got no business playing in this pool. And I hate to be the guy to say that, but that's the truth of it, is that you get better as you go along and your early stuff is going to blow chunks. And I don't mind that. If you go back and, hey, artandstorypodcast.com, everybody, go back and listen to episode 1. It's brutally bad. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I encourage people to go listen to that, because then they're going to say, well, Jersey figured it out, or at least he's on the way to figuring it out, you know?
Oh, God. Dude, and now you were actually very practiced at the beginning of Thunder Punch Daily. Sorry to interrupt. But that's another example where Thunder Punch Daily, which is fully linked into on the leanintoart.com site, not to distract traffic from Art and Story, because it completely deserves it. And it's a wonderful, it's a beautiful thing. And it's an example of how things, you know, let's see, of the, I don't know what to say. I want to say something wise and Buddhist-y, but like, yeah, essentially things can come to an end or whatever, right?
Sure.
And it's beautiful. And you should, you know, listen to the whole damn archive of Art
Mono
Story.
Mono no aware, the beauty of impermanence.
Yep, impermanence.
The world of dew is such a world of dew. There we go. There was our Zen.
Thanks, man.
anyway, but yes, but even Thunder Punch Daily, the idea of doing it on my own was scary. And I did a couple first takes, and it wasn't working. And I was stammering, I was stuttering. And finally, I just said, suck it up, Jers. Just dive in and do it, you know?
My God, and the progression. That's the thing, is like hearing you. So part of the thing why I mentioned the Thunder Punch Daily is because it's so isolated, right?
Yeah.
And it could be the whole torture chamber you set up for yourself.
I did.
With the whole, I'm going to do a thesis every time, and which is awesome. And I highly respect it, tip my hat, but and you freaking pulled it off. And that's you set a high hurdle, and it was interesting to watch you adapt to that and get better and better and better at it over the course of that podcast. Yeah. And because it's isolated, it's just one guy facing that hurdle.
And I set up creative challenges in order to force myself to execute. So I said, well, when I pick up Ann from work, I've got a 10-minute wait in the car, and often because, you know, but for whatever reason, it would take her a while to like actually get out of the building. This is when she was working at the library. And so I'd be sitting in the parking lot for 10 minutes at a go. I said, well, that's when I can do it. I've got my phone. I got this great recording app on there. I'll just record it in the car. And then that means the moment I pull into that parking lot, I've got 10 minutes. And I've got to get the thing done before I see her walk out that door, because that's when I have to say, you know, thanks again. See you guys next time.
And remember everybody.
Oh, and remember everybody. Yeah, I always close the He-Man quote. But I locked myself in the car. You know, it's like, you're sitting in the car. You can't go anyplace else. You're sitting in a parking lot waiting for somebody, and you got a 10-minute countdown, right?
Like podcasting Houdini. I can't get out of this, and I'm going to fill the tank with water.
And I didn't always do a good job of it. You know, it's like there are plenty of stinker episodes in there, probably more than a few stinker episodes in there. I haven't gone back and listened to them, but the point is that I forced myself into a rhythmic cycle with it, to where it got to the point where, and this is where I saw other benefits, was in my classrooms. When I'm teaching high school, there's a lot of classes where a great teachable moment pops up about a topic that I addressed on a Thunder Punch Daily, and I've got the talk in my pocket. bam, I can just pull it out and here we go, everybody. And it looks like I'm just the most knowledgeable guy in the world. But what it was just practice. I was practicing. But, you know, I mean, it's like what I want. But I want to go back and stop patting myself on the back about the Thunder Punch Daily thing is this idea of the consistent human being, right? This static thing that we just have to be forever and ever and ever and not allow ourselves to be dynamic and changing, I think is a really, really poisonous idea, a really dangerous idea. And it's something that, you know, when you read marketing talk and you see it applied to a corporation where you have to have your branded message and everything, yeah, I get that. But guess what? Corporations, we never identify with them like a person. We don't look at Coca-Cola and go, my friend. Right? We don't look at, you know, Apple and go, they care about me. We never do that. Even though, even if you're an Apple fanboy, you don't look at the Apple logo and feel like the warmth of friendship, like greeting somebody across an airport hangar, you know, and like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad to see you. No, because they're corporations, they're impersonal. And that works for an impersonal, implacable symbol. But for a human being, we have foibles and flaws. And then we say this all the time in storytelling. It's like, oh, a character who is flawed is more interesting. Well, then how come we don't get to be flawed? How come we don't get to let our history have stains and weird parts? Because here's another thing, is that weird part might be the thing that actually makes you lovable to people. That yeah. might be the thing that makes... So I'm at ALA this past week. And, you know, for years, I got a lot of flack about my laugh on these different shows I do. A lot of people making fun of me about the way I laugh or the high pitch of my voice or the fast speed that I talk. I got so many compliments from, I guess something about my voice works for librarians because so many librarians came up to me and said, you have a great voice. I listen to your shows. You have just such a great radio voice. I'm like, what? And that's the way I said, what? Are you kidding me?
And someone's glass broke.
Dispelling the myth totally right there. No. But you never know what about your particular idiosyncrasies is going to be appealing to somebody. And the only way to find that out is to express it and let it be a little dirty. And I'm not saying be irresponsible and just let it all hang out and just spill out whatever garbage you got in your mind. Yeah, you have to self-edit. And yeah, you have to like try to polish it and make it match your taste as best as you can. But there is a point where you just got to let the thing go down the river and be a thing and move on to the next one. Otherwise, you're just going to be permanently in this continuous cycle of, yeah, I'll do it tomorrow.
Or I will, you know, I'll do it again and again.
Yeah.
And then I will just lock it away. So no one can see me fail. And the thing is, I am so not into that idea in general. And I embrace that when you and I podcast and I know not every, I don't know, part of every show. I think we have strong parts of just about every show, I think, but yeah. You know, I know that there's definitely stinker parts or what have you, but, and I know I do that. Like I've been a big proponent of that as far as learning. There's a whole bunch of buttons that you hit as far as when you were kind of like running through a big room, going button, 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 button. You're like a room full of organs and you had the Beethoven hair going da 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 da, like, and you're just jamming all over the place.
Yeah, sorry. I got mad.
My God. No, it's good. But like, holy moly. I feel like responding to your tune here. Having an imperfect history, definitely a concern. Brands and companies, right? Versus individuals, even brands, it's baloney. I think people experience a cognitive dissonance that they don't necessarily unbox and figure out where you have this mythology. So for instance, going to a conference and they expose, we have this new feature, et cetera, and it sounds like it's an eternal permanent strategy that you can believe in and you have a shared mission, but in truth you don't. And they may just cancel that thing that you studied for like 2 years, mm-hmm. right? They're not your friend, right? And right. Even if they did put it out there as if it's going to be permanent, that's just so everyone feels good about and buys in enough to that permanency myth for the brand. Even brands have quirks and foibles and because it's just made of a bunch of people that are working under a banner, right?
Yeah.
And I would love to I haven't fully chewed on this, but I've taken the nibble and set it down and put it in the fridge. of brand, right? Yeah. In general. Cause I don't know, a few months back I read the Wikipedia page on brand and it really stuck in my craw of we're at this weird point in history where there's like a full cycle going of, and I'm not just dodging the topic, I'll come back. But maybe I am dodging the topic. but a cycle where brands were the foreign thing. Brands weren't trusted at first, right? Because it didn't feel genuine. Like people were like, wait a minute. I know Jersey down the street hand makes comics and his family has for generations. I'm going to buy those comics. Who the heck is Marvel? Right.
Right. Right.
And it took a lot of effort, a lot of marketing and whatnot for things like Quaker Oats and all that to take off, where they were some of the early brands that people were exposed to that they didn't come from their local craftspeople that were in their,
yeah,
at least if not circle of friends in their community that they were aware of.
But okay, but to get you back at answering the question, even though that was an excellent point, I'm not trying to, you know, step on that.
And yeah, anyway, it's an interesting area that's bookmarking it for like.
That's, yes, that is dog-eared for follow-up because that is a fascinating topic. But look at what you did right after I finished screaming at you was you said, I know this is a thing I struggle with and I know that this is a thing that I espouse the virtues of. You're punishing yourself already just by feeling bad about being inconsistent in that regard, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. It's like, I don't want to turn into stupid helpy tips.
Let go.
I don't want to turn into stupid helpy tips. I really don't. But it's just, this is something I struggle with a lot myself. And the thing about that the Kazoo interview on the Kids Comics Revolution podcast was he made me go, you know, I should be having a lot more fun on Twitter. Even though he was talking about how he doesn't post that much and he thinks really hard about what his intended audience is and who he's writing for and everything, the fact that he said, I don't worry about hanging on to readers that much. I'm always looking for new readers. And man, oh man, that was
so damn. It seems it's crazy. Like he is. Everyone who's listening to this needs to listen to that episode of the podcast. He's a really, obviously, you know, Jersey and Dave are awesome, and they picked one heck of a guest, and you just got to listen to this guy.
Yeah, he said some super smart stuff.
He rocks, and it just that he's a very, and he was handing out like the best fortune cookies ever.
Yeah. But in a natural way, where it wasn't like packaged. Yeah, it wasn't
awesome.
Susie
handmade.
Orman,
every one of them a unique artisanal fortune cookie.
Artisanal fortune cookies, which you can get when you come to Ann Arbor for Kids Read Comics. By the way, everybody, damn, I really wasn't trying to pause for laughter there. I did have a cough churning up, but to go back to this thing about like, yeah, you know what? If you make somebody mad or turn them off because you did one little thing that they didn't like, that might be the very thing that brings in a new constituent, right?
Oh, gosh, exactly. And there's people that I will have tuned off because of this or tuned into because if it hits me in the right genuine way where I'm like, you know what? They are just being themselves. And I love being surrounded by that.
Yep.
And they're embracing the idea that, well, they're doing their best, but they're flawed. And so what? They just keep doing.
There are plenty of people whose work I enjoy who I would not want to have dinner with. Oh, and I don't wish any ill will on them. I just don't want to be in the same room with them necessarily, if I can help it. But I really love their work. I love the stuff that they produce. I know it's kind of a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their brain around. I mean, there was a Brady Bunch episode about this, for crying out loud, where like one of the Brady kids finds out that one of his heroes is kind of a jerk. And then they said like, well, or maybe this is a growing pains. I don't remember. But they're like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to like his work or are you going to like the man? You know, and he's like, oh, I guess I'll just continue to like his work and realizing that there's a separation between these two things. But also there's a connection between these two things in the sense that they're just a human being after all. And maybe if I act more like a human being, then it'll be okay when this person does something that I don't agree with. And you can just shut it off. And so, yeah, that's why I walked away from that Kazoo episode going, man, I should be having more fun on Twitter because every time I start to construct a post, I'm like, what are people going to think? Are they going to think I'm spamming them? Are they going to think that I said something stupid? Are people going to not think I'm funny? Oh, I'll just won't say anything. And, oh, man, am I going to go through my whole life that way? You know, I said probably 10 dumb things at ALA last week. 10. I know there was at least one moment where I said something that made somebody look at me. They gave me one of those looks like, what did you just say? You know, and there was another time where somebody kind of gave me like a shush, 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 shush symbol. Like, dude, you're talking about something that you shouldn't be talking about here. I won't say what those things are, but those are two instances where I went, oh, I said something dumb. And then, you know what? I won't say that dumb thing again.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. That happens. That happens.
But what are you going to do? You got to go walk outside and like, oh, gee, kick a rock and I just won't talk anymore. That'll show them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that often is the answer you can just kind of shut off or not share, or hole up, whatever. Go to safety, right? I mean, yeah. And the weird thing I'll excuse it. And not to say that this has been bugging me for months, and I've been trying to chew on it, right? Because when I do the Polytechnic cast, that's why I've admitted it a couple times on the podcast where I'm like, you know, I'm doing this thing that I know it isn't a good idea. and I am chewing on it, working on it and trying to, you know, break through it. And I finally actually we're going to have so many loose ends on this one, but so be it. Right. I was, what was it? So Tuesday, I thought, you know what? I'm in the mood to podcast and I'm going to do it. Right. So I went and took a couple swings at trying to get it done. And then I just, you know, forced myself to finish one. And, oh my God, it was hard. I don't know why. When we create things, I'm creating it because I want to, I want to help. And I want to live that example of like, well, here you guys were, sharing your genuine experience of making that thing, of that product, you know, back on the Art Story Supreme days. Mm-hmm. And also talking about the other projects you were working on and different aspects of it, each one of you in your own different way. And I thought, it is that inconsistency. It is that progression. It is how you changed. I get to see you change. I get to experience the process of learning.
Yeah.
And I'm a freaking addict when it comes to that.
Yeah.
The process of learning. I'm like, that's a great way to be. I'm going to be that. And then at the same time, I have an inconsistent time with it because, well, you know.
Well, I mean, one wants to do a good job, you know? I mean, if you care about something, when you're passionate about something, you want to do a good job of it. Like I said earlier, I'm not advocating being callous or cavalier about what you do. So it's tough. It's tough because you want to do a good job of it, and when you don't feel like you're giving it your level best, or maybe you feel like you gave it your level best and it's still not good enough, that's when it gets really frustrating, right? That's where it's like you start beating your head against the wall. But we just did an episode on iteration where I was talking about, I found out that sometimes my first idea isn't necessarily my best idea, or I find out through iterating that my first idea was my best idea, but now I know why, instead of just having like that gut feeling, right? But then there are times when it's okay to let the sketch do the living. Think about what... Now I'm going to totally get stupid helpy tip. Think about what the Technicast is. You just said yourself that one of the things you enjoyed about those microcasts was it was watching us be learners and watching us go through that learning process, both in a meta sense through the way we execute the show, both in the deliverables in terms of what we report on in every episode, right? In that sense, then doesn't that format necessitate it having a sketchy kind of texture to it rather than a fully polished professorial kind of lecture up at the, you know, on the mount, right? Mm. So, I mean, I think part of it comes down to you have to also determine what the parameters of the project are. So, like, if I'm doing a project for, say, a Marvel Comics, not that I am, but they're going to demand a certain kind of level of quality and production values for the money that they pay me. Whereas if I'm doing something for, you know, quick and dirty indie publisher, maybe they would intentionally want a sketchier or more raw or more emotional look to the work because that's the parameters of the project. So like when you say like something like lean into art, one of the things I'm enjoying about this particular audio project is the fact that we sometimes just a minute before we hit the record button, or even like even after we hit the record button, we land on what we're actually going to talk about.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Kids Comics Revolution, in the discussions I've gotten into with Dave, was if anybody's heard it, it's a very produced show in the sense that it's edited a lot. It's not a one-take show like Lena Tart is. And part of that was because we were considering who our audience is. We're trying to reach this specific audience, and they're going to have these kinds of expectations. They're not going to sit through 2 hours of two guys talking philosophically about something. So I think that's the way you self-edit in determining when it's okay to let something breathe and just live as a sketch. And I got one more thing I want to say about this, and then I'll shut up.
I'm thinking this is good stuff. Please.
Something Anne said to me once about, and it was kind of like it broke my heart at the time. She was looking at my thumbnails. So I don't know if you've ever seen my thumbnails, Rob, in terms of like in real life. But when I'm thumbnailing a book, I tend to like do like a saddle stitched actual folded copy book. I don't just do it on loose. I do like my first initial pass on loose sheets of paper, but then I bind a little booklet that I do the final thumbnails in. So they're like this little pristine thing. And I always put on the cover the title and the date completed. And it's a ritual that I have with the way I do my thumbnails. And Anne was flipping through one of the books that I just finished. I think it was PPV. This would have been about 2002. And she was watching me draw the final page. And she said, "Wow, your thumbnails always look like 20 times more energetic than your final art." I was like, oh. As a guy who really strives to get a lot of energy in his work, that hurt. That one really hurt. She's like, "Well, can't you just like blow it up and like work off of that?" And I'm like, "No, because the anatomy's wrong and the perspective's wrong. It's just a loose sketch." She's like, "Yeah, but there's an energy there. There's an energy that is not happening on the final page." In other words, the thumbnails had value. They had a communicative value distinct from the final page. Final page was more polished. Final page had more production value, had more anatomical correctness and perspective correctness, but that didn't match with the level of energy and enthusiasm that was in those initial thumbnails. Which one is the right one?
Yeah, well, and that would be up to the eye of the beholder, right? The audience.
Amen. The audience gets to decide this. You know, I mean, it's the artist counts. The artist counts a lot. Like, you get to decide how the copyright is handled on your work. You get to decide who gets to say what about you in terms of, like, whether it's slander or libel or whatever. You get to determine whether anybody gets to make any money off your work or not, right? But who gets to decide whether or not the work is ultimately appreciated and understood and enjoyed? The audience gets to decide that. You know?
Yep.
Check it, checkmate.
I don't know. It's the 2x4. It may have left a dent. You swung that thing. You connect.
I am bearing a startling resemblance to Hacksaw Jim Duggan right now.
Yep, exactly. Got the thumbs up and that. Anyway.
I'm sorry. You stepped on a corn with that topic. That's something I've been really mad about for a while.
That's it. We're deleting this one.
Okay, yeah. Take two. Take two.
No, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Well, there's probably somebody who thinks I'm wrong, too. But you know what? That comes with the gig.
Stepping back, like, to me, this topic resonates with me when it comes to how I look at learning. I mean, and learning and adapting and iterating and playing and immersing yourself and responding and all these things that like come with transformation of you didn't know something or you didn't know how to do something, and then you come out of this other path of experience different.
Yeah.
And if you don't allow the path, you don't get the result on the other end.
Yeah.
That's pretty dang like authoritative sounding. That's the voice in my head. That's what I tell myself.
Yeah.
And I feel pretty strongly about it that one way to look at it is I'm stealing the chance to learn. That experience, I've thrown it away.
Nobody gets to be wise by doing it right every time.
Yeah.
You know?
And there's no way to build the wisdom. You can't, like, the bricks that you get to assemble your whatever shape of the house of wisdom you're building are formed by those passage moments and the things that you did, and you know, like it, sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, and then you repeated it, and then you got the all like 1,000 consistent bricks, but then you decided to try another thing, and now the bricks got wonky again. Mm-hmm. But over time, you're changing, and you can't transform without trying that learning process. If it's shortcut, you know, cheaters never win.
That's what He-Man says.
Yeah. I was trying for a stupid helpy tip. It really is like a shortcutting thing. It's more
of like a bypassing thing, right? It's trying to like bypass the whole process of experiencing something. And just to try to come out looking like that still store at the end of the TV show episode when it says produced by so-and-so, you know?
And to tie it back to the podcasts that you guys did on Art and Story Supreme, everyone who listened to those podcasts got to watch that transformation and go along on that with you. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very valuable demonstration of it. Anyway.
I mean, to put it in a context, I mean, this is obviously this is not to discount editing, refinement, polishing, production values, trying to do a good job of something, making a work match your level of taste, to use the Ira Glass language. It's not to discount any of that, but there is a time where it's time to just push the plunger, pull the trigger, or whatever other stupid metaphor you want to throw on it, to say, let this thing live. Let this thing go out there and be something. And what's the worst that can happen? Somebody's going to look at it and go, not my thing. Right? Or like you're gonna like, what are you gonna run for president or something? And somebody's gonna come up to you and it's like, Mr. Stenzinger, Congressman Stenzinger, I feel obliged to inform you about this podcast that you did X amount of years ago.
Yeah, exactly. You're no public speaker. You said like 5 times in 2 seconds.
And I don't even think is a bad word. I think people get that too hard of a rap.
Yeah.
I think it becomes an audio bridge to thoughts rather than just pure silence. I think it's not that big a deal. I think people give themselves way too hard a time about that kind of thing, listening to their ums and ahs. And that's another thing. It's like I think about this is also giving the audience sometimes too much credit. It's like I think about when I worked at that one of my crappy old jobs when I was a kid, and I had long hair like yours and a beard. And what did I do? I shaved my beard off, I think. I shaved my beard off, and I came to work the next day, and they're like, hey, you cut your hair. Everybody says that. Oh, you cut your hair. No, I didn't. I had a beard yesterday. I had a big beard. I had a big old hippie beard, and it was gone. And people were like, oh, there's something different about you, but I can't put my finger on it. People are not that observant. And, you know, you think about, like, when you're a kid, you got a zit or whatever, and you're like, oh, I'm going to go outside, and people are going to laugh at me. Nobody notices that stuff. Nobody ever notices that stuff. And they're not going to notice whatever kind of weird idiosyncrasy in your voice or in your work that you're getting so riled up about. Nobody's going to catch that. And those who do, it's possible they might be responding to it in a way that makes them like it even more, because that's that weird thing that only Rob Stenzinger does, right?
It's funny. I know I have a weird way of saying things, and I like it. Actually, in meetings, people will just run up to the whiteboard and write something down that I said.
Yeah.
And just like where we're having a podcast, then you'll like leap on it and be like, yep, there's a thing. I don't know. And it's something that I would love to become more self-aware about. But honestly, I partially don't care, because I just have to, you know, just keep expressing stuff. And I don't know. But it is weird. And sometimes that I could look at that as my zits, right? That's like, oh my gosh, I cannot speak as eloquently as Ira Glass, or, you know, as if I think the only thing I've listened to in like 2 decades of that something that Ira Glass did is the talk that you're referring to. and it is incredible. It's worth linking to if anyone who is into creating hasn't heard it. It's really sage advice. And
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. It's the kind of perspective you get when you practice the heck out of something, and you end up reaching the point of the taste that caused you to have the passionate reactions to it in the first place, where now you're able to execute on that level. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Executing on that level takes a huge path of learning, and you know, it's different for everybody. Obviously, I think, yeah, I don't know, some things come more naturally, whatever. I don't think it's like a 10,000 mistakes or 10,000 hours.
Oh, yeah. You're putting some arbitrary number on it.
Answer,
yeah. And I don't even think the people who use those arbitrary numbers really mean those arbitrary numbers. They're just throwing out a large number to say, it's going to take a while, kid. And then to which the kid always says, but how long? And then they say, oh, 2,000 pages. I don't know. Just something, you know. But
a lot.
That's to drive home this idea that a 21-year-old can't understand, is that it's going to take a long time because everything needs to be immediate when you're younger. And even now, I'm still going, like, how are we there yet? But yeah, I'll link to that in the show notes. And it feels like we're wrapping up on this.
I think we are. I don't know. I mean, you think I learned my lesson? You think I'm ready to...
In today's story, today was a day for big surprises. And the biggest surprise of all was when Rob learned to express himself.
Shut up, Jersey. I'm just kidding. No.
I think that the big one for me that helps me get through this kind of stuff is just to remember that I'm an inconsistent human being, and that is like what makes me interesting. Mm. Not to everybody. You know, but
how about let's see. No, that's cool. It's good. You're definitely the Yoda of this episode. So I'm not going to because you got to wonder, so when does Yoda run into these things? Or does it, you know?
Of course Yoda runs into these things. Everybody runs. Just because I said a lot of stuff with like an angry voice doesn't mean that I don't struggle with the same crap all the time. And as a matter of fact, the reason I'm getting mad is because I struggle with this crap all the time. Hmm. Every day. You know, I say something and then somebody misinterprets what I said. I'm like, oh, crap, they think that I said something mean and I didn't really mean to say something mean. I should just, you know, try not to say things so much because I don't want people to think that I'm mean, you know.
For me, it's expressing something and then having it, the words just be pretty much noise where someone just looks at me kind of blankly or with a puzzled expression. I'm like, wow, I didn't express that right. But you know what? That's it. So be warned, folks. There's two episodes of the Polytechnicast that are coming your way.
Well, good. And then maybe after Kids Read Comics, I can pull the trigger on some of mine.
Cool.
So, yeah, if you thought this was fun, if you enjoyed listening to me and Rob riff on these kind of things, a great thing you could do is go to iTunes and give us a star review and just choose how many you think we deserve. I think this one was a 4, if not 5, star episode. But you don't have to agree with me. You can put 2 if you want to. But just it's an anonymous thing. It just takes a few seconds of your time. Go into iTunes, look up Lean Into Art. Give us a star review. That'll help other people find the show if you think other people need to hear the show. You don't even have to say why. Just give however many stars you think is appropriate. So, Rob, thanks so much for this episode. This was fun.
Super cool, Jersey. You know what I'm going to do real quick?
Yeah.
I want to tease a workshop that's coming up.
Okay.
At Lean Into Art. Just real quick. All right. So one of the ways, if you do dig the podcast, you know, please do rate us on iTunes and whatnot. We super appreciate it. I know it's an extra thing. It's like you have to go out of your way. You might be like, I don't use iTunes. I use a podcatcher on my device or whatever. But yeah, it's a place where a lot of people do congregate. And though, like, your votes actually do matter and it's helpful. So anyway, another way is if you would like these ideas or the things from the community of teachers and teaching artists that we've gathered together that have put on workshops at Lean Into Art, you could support us by checking out our workshops page, leanintoart.com/workshops. We have a new one coming up. The page isn't posted yet. Might be by the time this podcast goes live. We'll see. But Tyler James is coming back for another awesome workshop that... So speaking of intentional artists, I actually gave a huge commercial for Tyler on one of the Polytechnic casts that will hopefully see the light of day as I, you know, Jekyll and Hyde wrestle myself to click the publish button. He is coming back with he's speaking of it in like intentional artists and people who he really has a holistic approach to producing comics that includes the business side. I mean, he's looking to really grow a healthy, sustainable business and a community and all that. And he captures his ideas. And heck, I mean, he actually and he currently works for a video game company, but he's been a school teacher as well. Definitely a good teacher, right? And has a teacher's mind where he's capturing the stuff. He's got a new one coming out called Rack My Book, Successful Micro Distribution Strategies of a Maverick Independent Comic Book Publisher. He's kind of a maverick. I could see him wearing like a huge hat.
And
like being authoritatively awesome with it.
See, I was thinking of Maverick from Top Gun.
Ooh, or he could fly a jet.
He takes my breath away, that Tyler.
Perhaps Tyler will play sand volleyball. I don't know. We can ask him.
And Rob will be flying Gooseman for that one. But yes, so Rack My Book is coming soon. Okay.
And anyway, that's and he is someone who has brought his books to the shelves of local comic distribution, which is pretty cool. I mean, there's definitely more and more independent artists that have done that, but he formed his own label and his own distribution arrangements and whatnot, which I can't wait to learn from this class to delve into it. So that's going to be posted coming soon. And I think it'll be at the last Wednesday in July is when we're talking about having it happen. So pencil that in on your calendars.
There we go. Last Wednesday in July. Eastern, probably. Eastern time. So like if you're like on the other side of the world, it'd be Thursday your time. I will say that this final thought on Tyler's workshops. So he did Absolute Consense for us, which I brushed up on before I went to ALA. And I was so prepared for the show that I was loaning setup materials to other artists because he talks about the con box in his workshop. And I went through and I just went through his checklist and I used everything in the con box. I brought it to ALA and there were people who were like, oh, I don't have this. I don't have that. I got it. I was the camper who was fully prepared for everything. And there were other people who had to, you know, so I was kind of like the nice guy of the show floor loaning out setup materials.
Awesome.
So that's how feels good. Workshops. Yeah,
it feels good. You can become that, wow, how is that, you know, how is she so prepared? You know, well, you know, the secret is Tyler's class.
That's what I did. I winked and a little sparkle came on my teeth.
So, awesome.
He's the E.F. Hutton of comics workshops.
Totally.
All right. So, hey, I guess we should get going before too long. So leanintoart.com/workshops is how you can support us if you like this stuff or give us a review on iTunes. Until next week, everybody, my name is Jersey Drozd, and I'm at comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I am Rob Stenzinger, and you can visit me on Twitter at Rob Stenzinger and at interactive-storyteller.com.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.